Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona, Rebecca, it's been a minute since we've done an episode, but I know there's been a lot of updates, a lot of changes, a lot of happenings in the EB5 industry in the last month.
Well, when is there not a lot of happening, Mark?
Right.
we definitely have quite a few things to discuss, though, on this episode, right, Rebecca?
Yeah, we have plenty to catch up on. I know the summer has been busy with everything going on, but we wanted to give our listeners an EB5 update and see what's happening.
Yeah, and a little bit of a litigation update, because the circuit courts have been quite busy, too.
Oh, yes. We have plenty to discuss on that. I think one of the main or major topics, Mona, we wanted to discuss was what's going on with the EB5 bulletin.
Yeah, Rebecca, we've been talking about the EB5 bulletin for, well, gosh, almost as long as we've been doing this podcast, for 7-8 years. Mona, what's going on with the EB5 bulletin?
Well, there's always an issue with the EB5 bulletin, Mark, in the sense that we haven't had enough visas since perhaps 2016 or 2017. But the difference right now is that since the passing of the EB5 Reform and Integrity Act, REIA, as we all call it, when an investor files a petition, they have to delineate exactly what type of project they're going into. Is it going to be rural? Is it going to be a TEA? Is it a non-TEA? This is going to be significant moving forward. Rebecca, do you want to explain?
Yeah, so there's a lot of confusion with the visa bulletin, unfortunately, because we have pre-REIA cases and post-REIA cases. So now you have to differentiate between those who filed prior to 2022 and those who filed thereafter. So I want to start first with the pre-REIA cases, those who filed before March of 2022.
Rebecca, I just remembered there's been a ton of activity, because it looks like India has caught up. It says that India is now in December 2019.
And that is the confusion. So yeah, we've got a lot of clients who came up and are so excited. They're like, oh, it's December 8th, 2019. But the difference is that's Chart B, dates for filing. And now, you know, Mark, you've seen, we've discussed this, like you said, plenty of times in articles, on our podcast episodes. The issue is that's only for those who can file whether an AOS application or at the consulate. It doesn't mean a visa is available for that client. Now, the visa availability for India is back to April 1st of 2017. And the second issue is, Mona, is that, you know, they came up with Chart B, which was great. Now you can file your AOS application. And of course, REIA changed the rules where we can now file concurrent filings for our clients. Problem is that USCIS has now said that you cannot file under Chart B for the past few months, that you can only file if your priority date is current, which is April 1st of 2017.
So what's the point of Chart B then?
Exactly. Well, for those who filed previously, especially for those as soon as the rules changed, a lot of our clients, you know, we had that big filing period of AOS application. They were lucky. They were able to get their EADs, their travel permits, even though it took forever. But unfortunately, I think why USCIS closed it for the last few months is to kind of figure out where are they? How many applications do they have filing? Because it's just so many with the new changes and the priority dates becoming current at this point that they're probably inundated with so many applications. But we're hoping to see that they open it in the next coming months.
Okay, so just let me understand this. So the Chart B is akin to a door, which USCIS can open and close at their own whims and fancies.
It seems like it. So every month we have to pay attention and just kind of take a look and see when they will reopen the filing for adjustment of status. Now, that doesn't bother for a consular processing. We could go ahead and do that. But for adjustment of status, it does kind of give us some restrictions on when to file.
Okay, so now this is going to lead us to the next point, because the September EB5 visa bulletin is showing that the quotas will be reached, I think, in almost all categories except infrastructure for 2023's fiscal year. Is that correct?
Yes, yes, we have seen that. I mean, there's so many applications pending. And then, you know, we've seen all the filings coming in for those who want to go in the visa set aside. So
wait, the new ones, this is post RIA. This is post March of 2022. So we're talking about the set asides being filled up already.
Yes. And it's not even, it's what, just over a year. So we said this before, Mona, too. I think we predicted after 2 years, I can see the set asides category, maybe not infrastructure so much, but definitely rural and TEAs being backlogged.
Okay, so now again, Mark, as you said, why is the EB5 visa bulletin so important? This is something I need to understand, Rebecca, and perhaps you can, because I really don't understand it, and I'm sure there's a lot of our listeners don't understand. If you've checked your little box, which said rural or TEA, and now we are looking at a possible backlog moving forward, maybe not such a long backlog, but what will the State Department do with the unreserved visas? Is there an overflow? What happens? Well, is it a 2-year rollover?
I mean, at the end of the day, they gave each new set aside a percentage. Right. So if you can't technically go over that percentage, if rural is given 20% of the visa count, that's where they will have to limit, unless there's additional visas from the unreserved category. But I don't see that happening, because there's so many that still need to get adjudicated under pre-RIA. First of all, I mean, there's a backlog of cases that needs to get adjudicated. So you really, I mean, at the end of the day, what USCIS needs to do, or hopefully Congress, is give us more visas or take away the dependence, because I don't see the reserved category set aside. I feel like everything's going to end up in backlog.
Yeah, that will be a disaster, because then that would be a backlog on a backlog.
Yeah, but we, you know, we've had this discussion before, like, okay, maybe not much was happening in 2020, 2021. Remember, the regional center program was closed at a certain point. Did we see a lot of filings? A lot of people are withdrawing. Do you think we may see more visas in the unreserved category, because we'll see maybe people wanting to go into the set-aside visas, or people getting denied, or what are we going to see?
Well, here's the thing. At the end of 2019, if you remember, there was that huge, mega huge rush to file before the amount went up to 900,000 under the regulations. And it wasn't just us. We know that almost every law firm was just inundated. So we have all of those visas still to go, because I believe that USCIS is still only around May of 2019. So there's a ton of visas to be adjudicated. But saying that, there have been quite a lot of people who have withdrawn, or we might be seeing a bunch of denials. We're still seeing a far higher amount of denials than we are approvals right now. So that could change the statistics. But yes, you're right. Unless we get more visas, certain countries will remain backlogged. And I really have to emphasize, it's not everybody. It's only at this point, China and India. But there is a possibility, Rebecca, that we might see Brazil and South Korea in that same category.
Yes, we could. The thing is, though, I know we're coming into the new fiscal year. So October 1st, we'll see, you know, the new visas will be released. So I really think, and you know, for our listeners out there, you know, we'll come back in October and see where we are. Let's see how the visa is coming out. Let's see where USCIS is at that point. I think we'll have a better determination of how backlogged India and China will be under the unreserved category.
Right. Well, to follow on from that topic, I think it's really important that we discuss what I call the rural phenomena. So the rural phenomena really came about from, again, RIA, where there was a set aside of 20% only for rural projects. And there was an added incentive for people to jump into this category, because the processing speed and the adjudication speed is so much faster. And we are actually seeing it. There's a bunch of regional centers who are out there who have been pushing on rural and have said that they've had their petitions approved, which means, Rebecca, they would have had to have their F filings approved first before the E filings could be approved.
Oh, yes. So, yeah, they're saying they're getting these approvals under 1 year, which like we said, they have priority processing under RIA. But again, everybody's going into these rural projects. So, or, you know, how, and it's only 20% of the 10,000, right?
Well, we haven't had our rural projects approved yet. Those are still pending.
Yeah, well, I guess, I mean, but to be fair, I think our rural projects have been maybe 6 months. So we should be seeing approval soon.
So it really does look like USCIS is following what Congress have suggested that they really want, i.e. to push projects into the rural areas. But also, Rebecca, hasn't there just recently been a change in what's called the MSA and categories, TEA designations, areas which were part of rural areas and now no longer rural areas? And who decides all of this?
Yes. Yeah. There was major changes every few years. It's the government, actually. So U.S. decides which areas are, you know, in an MSA, which areas are rural projects.
MSA, Metropolitan Statistical Area.
So, yes, Mark. And it's, you know, it's just outside of the city limits. It's not really a rural area, but it's where we can find what's, you know, areas that are targeted employment areas.
But Rebecca, here's where I'm worrying. We haven't seen it as yet, but the adjudications are really made by USCIS based on perhaps the letters from economists and stuff. Mm-hmm. But isn't there a possibility that USCIS might decide that an area is not rural or it's not TEA, and suddenly everybody in that project is in a quandary?
Yes. So before RIA, right, the states kind of designated what was a TEA or what was a rural area, which, yeah, I thought was great, because as a state, you should have that determination and knowing where do you need the job creation. So now it's based on USCIS's decision or the Department of State. And I think we could see issues where if they continue adjudicating under a year, but still you as an investor, if you waited a year and now you figured out you're no longer a TEA or a rural area, what happens there? Do you need to put in that extra $250,000? Do they automatically deny you? Or could USCIS come up with a system where you can maybe put in your, you know, because Rona, we're seeing a lot of unreliable data. So I'm wondering if USCIS can put a system of like, look, we'll try to adjudicate at least the TEA within a 3-week period, get that approval, and then you file that with your F form.
That would be very reasonable. That would be super reasonable. Yeah, we should let USCIS know.
Yeah, but it's something that I think they should do, so that way you're not waiting, because at least all the other adjudicates, you know, you have to meet matter of hoe requirements for the project. So you were very familiar with that. But with the TEA, it's just, like I said, it's kind of up in the air. We've seen different data. We've seen one where it says somewhere was a TEA, and we've seen another site where it says it's not. So who do you depend on? What do you rely on? Mm-hmm. Or USCIS should just come out with their own system, their own TEA map, and have it done from one system versus getting it from all the different economists or different companies out there that are doing it.
All right. And the different maps even are not consistent. So that's true. But I do think this is going to be a topic that we'll be discussing, I'm sure, for the next year or so. But the future trend right now is, unless they get more visas for the rural areas, and they're capped at 20%. I know it rolls over for 2 years, but will future projects go for non-TEA areas? Because let's face it, Rebecca, the non-TEA areas are definitely going to be much easier for many developers to have more profitable projects.
Oh, yes. And I think here, I think the difference as well in the amount, I mean, we've said this plenty of times on our episodes, that our investors are savvy. They're going to look at projects and determine which one. I know a lot are running into the rule right now, but at the end of the day, if those visas are fulfilled, you know, $250,000 to look at projects that are in areas that you would think that the repayment would be faster, or you know there's going to be success. I think,
well, that doesn't mean to say there's not going to be good projects in the rural area.
No,
it is harder. It is definitely harder.
Exactly.
And thus far, we have seen that massive rush to file from China, basically. So,
yes.
Yeah.
No, and I agree. There are good projects in the rural area. But at the end of the day, there's not enough. I don't think there's going to be enough visas.
Yeah, for sure.
I think then a lot of projects, they're no longer going to differentiate between rural TEA or non-TEA. They're just going to see which one actually works for them.
Right, right. And the other big thing lately is not only the fact that rural projects are faster. I mean, it's also supposedly there is a new policy out there for faster adjudication. Or maybe USCIS is trying to temper everybody from moving away from WOMS by pretending there's a faster adjudication. But isn't there a new I-526 form which has recently been unveiled?
Well, the processing times, which they did in the past, right? The first in, first out visa approach, meaning that they're just trying to, what they're trying to do at this point, especially for pre-RIA cases, so those filed again before March 2022, they're trying to organize it in a way where they're trying to put them, like all the NCEs, all the investor cases with the same NCE, trying to get them to the same adjudicators. So they're trying to find ways to make it faster, especially for those who have been waiting for such a long time, because it's a bit unfair now that you've got all these rural projects being approved and then your pre-RIA who fought, let's say you filed since 2017 and you still haven't received an adjudication. But at the same time, they also had came out with the visa availability approach, which I thought was a great idea, especially if you have age out kids, because for instance, if you're a Chinese investor or Indian investor and you have a child who was turning 21, you filed right before they turned 21, that visa availability approach works because now your petition is going to sit there pending until a visa is available, which will help your child at the end of the day because their age will not run. Because once you're approved, the child's age begins to run again, remember. So you're allowed to subtract the pending time.
Yes, but here's where the visa availability approach has not worked. In those projects where they did not have children who aged out and where people wanted a repayment of their money and something happened to the project. Now, you know that we've had a lot of problems with projects post-COVID, and there are investors who've invested in those projects in 2015, 2016, and they would have got their green cards, or they would have had they would have had an adjudication, but for the visa availability approach. Now, if they'd had an adjudication under RIA, they really could have had a return of capital, or at least talked about having maybe interest or whatever. Without any adjudication, those people are just sitting there. And if projects have failed, those poor people now, they might still get their green cards, but they're not going to get a return of their capital.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's the tough part. You know, if you have an age-out kid, you want that. If you don't, and I guess it's for USCIS, it's, you know, how do you determine which one's an age-out case versus non? In my opinion, I think if you're filing before the age of 21, it doesn't matter. I think they should still get included and not even have the CSPA, the Child Status Protection Act. I think it's just, you know, I don't think it's helpful at all. But again, it's the regulations. It's hard to make everyone happy, I guess, at the end of the day.
Yeah, and here's another issue related to, again, this whole visa availability approach, is that as we have seen right now, there's been a number of denials and the denials have been elevated. It's very, very difficult going back to a project which either has been closed or may not have the data from 4, 5, 6 years ago. I mean, we know how difficult it is because so many projects, unless you are really on top of that project and you're getting specific data every year from that project, and how many do that? Because they don't retain their attorneys over a long period of time. And again, they've had their money. It's the investor who's lost out.
Yeah, it's really hard. I think for the most part, though, most projects have been keeping up or getting the data. I'm sure most regional centers did that with their projects. But at the end of the day, these denials, I feel that a lot of time at this point, I feel like USCIS is just handing out denials just because they don't want to adjudicate these pre-RIA cases. You know, they're just finding a way to get adjudication, the processing times faster. And so a lot of times it's either giving a annoyed. We've seen a lot of noise too without giving an RFE. We've seen denials coming out of this. I just feel that they're kind of hurting the pre-RIA cases without really looking into them and adjudicating them. They just want to kind of move on to the new cases that have been filed.
As you can see, Mark, your little question about what's going on with the visa bulletin.
And that's why we're here.
Yeah, I mean, it's great, you know, with RIA coming in, obviously the integrity measures have been great, having more compliance, having a fast route for rural projects, great. But it's kind of left those investors who filed previously, they are in a quandary. You know, it feels like I've had cases just sitting there and then they're getting to a few you'll get one or two approvals and then that's it. And then where's the rest? So I just feel that they're just delayed.
Well, we'll talk about how we feel about USCIS as a uniformity of decisions on another topic, but we are getting very, very frustrated again. We feel like we're moving backwards, like 10 years backwards with some of the adjudications.
Other than, you know, the visa bulletin, the visa availability approaches and first in, first out, we've seen a lot of this happening. But what else have we seen in the past few summer months?
Oh, well, there has been other issues. We have kept busy. I think just staying in the East for a while, to staying in China, I think we cannot but not mention the arrest of the president of one of the largest agents in China, which is Wai Lian. And there has been a lot of controversy from this. So very briefly, for anyone who doesn't know, very recently, I think it was, a week ago, the Chinese government arrested Linda Hay, who was the Wai Lian group president. And while Wai Lian has been in the EB5 industry for years and years and years, I think they've quoted something like placing 5,000 plus investors. So it was a huge deal.
Yes, Amona, as we've been discussing with this arrest, a lot of investors who, you know, from China are kind of worried, you know, is this going to affect their case? What really happened? I mean, to be honest, we don't really have the full facts because a lot of it doesn't even, it may not even have to do with EB-5. It could just be that from what we've heard, again, that it could have been just she had helped clients other than EB-5 investors transfer millions of dollars out of China.
Well, yes. The whole charge is that they try to bypass the Chinese government and do their own transferring. But I don't think it is focused so much on EB-5 as the focus is possibly on the Qi government wanting to slow down the migration wave that's been happening, especially post-COVID, because China did not treat its people very well during COVID. And there was, it could also account for this massive rush of people that we have seen coming out of China wanting to go in the rural projects. But whether it's EB-5 or whether it's CBI, it's definitely shaken a lot of the industry, and especially all the cottage industries, which come out around the migration elements. I mean, cottage industries, meaning people who put events together, people who help within the whole processing of these cases. There is a fear.
Yeah, I think what it is, it's that, you know, the Chinese government obviously didn't do well. The economy didn't do as well coming out of COVID. So obviously they're kind of targeting these areas of where they see the money coming out. Now, for investors, we might see it quiet down from China for a bit until they figure this out. I would say, though, for those who have already filed petitions, I mean, at the end of the day, USCIS, as long as you're, you know, a lot of people are worried about the path of funds. I think as long as you've done it in a way to show that your path of funds were legal, I think it'll be fine. And a lot of times, too, under for China, a lot of them did parallel transfers. So the money is still within China's economy, right? It just moved from one person to the other in RMB. And then it was parallel transferred from, let's say, Hong Kong. Someone who had US dollars transferred it to the petitioner. So RMB is still in the country. And then as long as you were able to show the source of the third parties, their source of funds, I don't see USCIS having any issues with this.
Right. I mean, at the end of the day, USCIS should be solely focused on US laws. They do cannot rely on agencies or foreign governments for this purposes anyway. And also, I don't think USCIS have any claim on any expertise in foreign finance laws in any event.
Yeah.
So, exactly. Yeah, you're right. They have to remember again this where the standard lies here. But let's see. Let's hope that we don't have any litigation coming out of some of the transfer of these cases.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think at the end of the day, it, like I said, I think it will have some Chinese investors who are thinking about the program. And obviously, they're going to have to find another way of, well, how do I transfer the funds? If it's not coming out from China, maybe, you know, they'll find a way to have it from outside of China. They've done it before. I'm sure they'll just take a little break and they'll be back again.
And just briefly, Mark and Rebecca, I do want to mention the denial of three cases out of the DC circuit, which just happened, and why this is important. It's important because these three cases there were amicus briefs filed by both IIUSA and AIIA. And these amicus briefs were in support of these cases, as the cases were related to unreasonable wait times. But unfortunately, the DC Circuit came down on the side of the government here and said there really wasn't an unreasonable wait time if you take into account the 9 months the program was closed and the problems relating to COVID. So whether that's a hit or a miss for WOMS, we will wait and see. But we can discuss this at another time.
Yeah, I agree, Mona. I think we have a lot to discuss because there's another case as well, the Gulf States Regional Center versus USCIS. Again, that's a whole new topic. I would just say on that case, for those who need to understand that you have to file your I-956, even if you were previously designated under old regulations, but I'll keep it short and brief. So please do file your I-956 to make sure you're still in status and you're still designated to be able to.
And Rebecca, it's shocking. There are many, many regional centers out there who haven't filed it.
Yes. Yeah. So I would say get going on it if you want to get your projects approved, your new projects with the I-956F filings, make sure the designation is filed.
Mona, Rebecca, thank you for this quick update. I know we covered a lot and sounds like we're going to have even more to go through in the near future.
Thank you, Mark.
Oh, yes. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshawlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.